Look at your outline, the top of page 38, D. It says, chapters 34 and 35 describe the division of the promised land to the tribes of Israel and the designated cities of refuge. Let's look at that just a minute. I'm switching back and forth between Bibles here because I've got some things marked in mine. All right. The point of chapter 34, if I hope you've read it. If not, when you do, you will see that God is just as specific about these cities and their borders and the where the land, what piece of land is to be given to what tribe, right up to the property line. He's just as detailed with this as he is with the tabernacle that we studied. And there's a southern border, a western border, a northern border, and an eastern border. And all of that territory is laid out inch by inch according to the Word of God. Now, and according to the tribes, and really that's what is in chapter 34. So I'm going to leave it at that, and we're going to move on. Look at the last verse in chapter 34, verse 29. These are the ones the Lord commanded to divide the inheritance. What's an inheritance? Something that someone has left for you. And who left this? Who gave this? God gave this. Among the children of Israel in the land of Canaan. This is the layout of the territory and the tribes who are to possess. Now, in chapter 35, do you remember that the Levites did not receive an inheritance of land all the way through? They've been set apart for different reasons, but they're set apart unto the Lord, aren't they? And because they're not given a territory, they are given cities. And so it talks about this in chapter 35. And these cities are not all in one place. So the Levite cities are scattered among the lands of all the other tribes to disperse them, to put them in among these other tribes. So it says in verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho, saying, command the children of Israel that they give the Levites cities to dwell in from the inheritance of their possession. And you shall also give the Levites common land around the cities. And I think the King James original King James says suburbs, so that word did not originate in America. It talks about suburbs around the cities. They shall have cities to dwell in, and their common land shall be for their cattle. So in other words, pasture lands and places to live are given out of the inheritance of the other tribes. And then it goes on and tells them how to measure those cities and how much, you know, outside the city property is theirs and so forth. Again, very, very specific instruction. And then it says in verse 6, let's look at that just a minute. Now among the cities which you will give to the Levites, you shall appoint 6 cities of refuge. And the phrase I want you to remember is cities of refuge. Now let's see what these were for. We're going to learn that as we go on through this chapter. To which a manslayer may flee. So they are literally asylums, a place where a man who has broken the law can run, not to avoid justice, but to be safe until justice can be administered. Okay, a manslayer is distinguished here from a murderer, and we're going to see that as we go through too. He's killed a man, but unintentionally. Okay? And to these you shall add 42 cities for the Levites. But 6 of the cities are to be cities of refuge. Okay? Now let's listen to this description of the cities of refuge, starting in verse 9. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall appoint cities to be the cities of refuge for you, that the manslayer who kills any person accidentally may flee there." But there are going to be some stipulations for this as well, so we better read on with this. "They shall be cities of refuge for you from the avenger." The avenger is the one who could come and take your blood for the blood of one lost in his family. "That the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation in judgment." What would we call that today? Until he has a trial, right? Until his case is presented. In other words, this would stop just, you know, you killed him, we're going to kill you. Well, you killed him, we're going to kill you. Just a chain reaction of killing. This would prevent that until the remedy could be sought and justice could be brought. "And of the cities which you give, you shall have six cities of refuge." Verse 14 is where I am. "You shall appoint three cities on this side of Jordan, and three cities you shall appoint in the land of Canaan, which will be cities of refuge." So we're going to put three over here in this land we've already taken, and three in the land of Canaan when you get across. Six cities. Verse 15, "Shall be for refuge for the children of Israel, for the stranger." Do you remember how one principle applied to those within the covenant and the strangers in the land, regardless, as we look through the rest of the chapters in Numbers? Well, the same thing holds true here when they break the law. So this is really for their well-being, too, when they're in the land. "For the stranger, for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person accidentally may flee there." So there's not a double standard with God. Have you heard that before? Yes, we have. "But if he strikes him with an iron implement," and then you can read down in verse 17, "if he strikes him with a stone." Verse 18, "if he strikes him with a wooden hand weapon." Anything which he does on purpose, okay, with an instrument in his hand, then it says he is a murderer. This is not accidental. And what is to be the fate of the murderer? The murderer shall surely be put to death. When people ask me if I believe in capital punishment, I say, yes, I do. Because God does. Verse 19, "The avenger of blood himself shall put the murderer to death." Now, there's a difference between murdering and accidentally killing, okay? So as we go through here, let's keep that in mind. God is talking about willful murder, even premeditated murder, he goes on to say. "If he pushes him out of hatred or while lying in wait," that's premeditated, "hurl something at him so that he dies, or in enmity, he strikes him with his hand so that he dies. The one who struck him shall surely be put to death." He is a murderer. "The avenger of blood shall put the murderer to death when he meets him." So that's not just capital punishment. That's pretty much instant justice, isn't it? When he meets him. Now, we could get into a long discussion, we're not going to tonight because we have more work to do, about how perverted the system has become from the immediate justice that God had in mind. And you can read about countries who have severe penalty for severe crime, where the punishment is severe enough that it makes the criminal accountable for what he's done. Then the crime rate is down. In this country, the taxpayers bear the financial burden of keeping people away from the rest of us so that we're safe while, you know, their sentence is extended. All right? And again, I'm not going to get into all that. And I thank God for the mercy of God for every one of us. But we have perverted God's ways. And it has cost us. It's like not driving the inhabitants out. And they've come back to destroy us. With our, you know, legal system, our penal system is perverted. You can buy your way out. You can bribe your way out. You can talk your way out. And it is not godly the way that justice is is handed down in our country. Okay, let me get back to where I was here. Okay, verse 21 is the one I just finished. So the avenger of blood, in other words, the one who would have the right to take action against what has been done, shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. Now, verse 22, however, if he pushes him suddenly without hatred or enmity, or throws anything at him without lying in wait, or uses a stone by which a man could die, throwing it at him without seeing him so that he dies while he was not his enemy, or seeking his harm. In other words, if it is an accident, then the congregation shall judge between the manslayer from the hand of the avenger of blood, and the congregation shall return him to the city of refuge where he had fled, and he shall remain there until the death of the high priest who was anointed with the holy oil. So if the judgment comes that you did what you did and it was an accident, then you are to go to a city of refuge, but you're to stay there until the death of the high priest. If the manslayer at any time goes outside the limits of the city of refuge where he fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the limits of that city, and the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, then he shall not be guilty of the blood. In other words, there was a covering for you, and that was the city of refuge. Interesting that one of the meanings of sanctuary is refuge or a place of safety and protection. I pray to God that holds true. It does of his sanctuary, doesn't it? It should of the people of his sanctuary. This should be the place where people can come for refuge and be safe. But outside the limits of that designated place, then you were open to the avenger. And it says if he slayed you outside those limits, then he would not be found guilty of that. Because he should, the manslayer should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of a high priest. But after the death of a high priest, the manslayer may return to the land of his possession. These things shall be a statute and a judgment to you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. And then there's one other very important verse that we need to see before we leave this one. And it says that whoever kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death on the testimony of witnesses. But one witness is not sufficient testimony against a person for the death penalty. So even then, it took two or more witnesses for the man to be found guilty and put to death. And then it says, moreover, you shall take no ransom for the life of a murderer who's guilty of death. He shall surely be put to death. You'll take no ransom for him who has fled to the city of refuge, that he may return to dwell in the land before the death of the priest. In other words, no compromises. This is the way it is. So you shall not listen to this. This is why God is so, you know, we think this is so hard. But listen to what he says. And then think about America. If you don't think we're under the mercy of God, say, you shall not pollute the land where you are. Because if murderers go free, you pollute the land where you are. And if the innocent are slain for something they didn't do, you pollute the land where you are. For blood defiles the land. Do you remember what God said to Cain in the book of Genesis after Cain had killed Abel? He said, the voice of his blood cries to me from the ground. Where's your brother? Well, there's a principle that was laid down in the book of Genesis that is referred to again here. He says, the blood defiles the land, and no atonement can be made for the land, for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. Now, I want you for just 1 second to think about the blood that is shed in the land of America every day when we abort babies. You talk about innocent. From the place that should be the safest place on earth for them to grow, they are taken and their blood is spilled in this land. And God says that defiles the land. America is defiled. By the mercy of God, we still enjoy the blessings that we do, because I know the voices of the innocent must cry from this land, from this very country that we live in, which is the best one to be in, before the face of God on a daily basis. It's a sad thought, isn't it? Therefore, he says in verse 34, do not defile the land which you inhabit, in the midst of which I dwell. Isn't that what we say about our country? God lives here. We're the ones who go preach the gospel to the other countries. But he dwells in the midst of this land. He says, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel, in other words, my people. Now, chapter 36 is a little bit more of what we got from chapter 27. It concerns the daughters of Zelophehad, and I hope there's time tonight to do a little bit more with that than I'm going to do right now, because we're going to get on to the review first. But what happens in chapter 36 is that the descendants of Joseph approach Moses. Let me find the verse here that I need. I have it highlighted. Let's read what it says here. 36 describes the concern over the inheritance of Zelophehad's daughter and the solution to that. You remember in chapter 27 that 5 daughters of Zelophehad came to Moses and said, our father died and had no sons. There's no one to inherit his possession. Why should it pass away with him? When he has children, he just doesn't have sons. And you remember that Moses listened. And we're going to talk about why he listened and what happened again tonight, I hope. If not, we'll talk about this some more after the test. But he went to God because it wasn't written what to do. This was something that wasn't in... I mean, the law had passed it down to sons, but this was a new problem. And so rather than just pass judgment by way of tradition and custom, the way it had always been, Moses went to God, and God said, these women speak right. They should get their father's inheritance. And that was settled. But later, their brethren in that same tribe came to them, and here's what they said to Moses. And again, they came to Moses before the leaders, the chief fathers of Israel, and they said, the Lord commanded, I'm in verse 2 of chapter 36, my Lord Moses, to give the land as an inheritance by lot to the children of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of our brother Zelophehad to his daughters. And they're not complaining about that. They said this is the way that it was set up. But here's the problem. Now, if they are married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the children of Israel, then their inheritance will be taken from the inheritance of our fathers, and it will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. In other words, their property is going to go from our territory over into the territory of the tribes in which, or tribe, in which all five of them marry. So we're going to lose land in this deal. We're going to lose territory. So it would be taken from our inheritance. And when the Jubilee of the children of Israel comes, and we remember Jubilee, when all land went back to its original owner, then the inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe into which they marry. So their inheritance will be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers. Then Moses commanded the children of Israel, according to the word of the Lord, saying, "What the tribe of the sons of Joseph speaks is right. This is what the Lord commands concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying," this is the solution, in other words, to this problem, "let them marry whom they think best, but they may marry only within the family of their father's tribe." And that will solve the problem. They are to marry within their own tribe. Now remember Pete talking about being yoked and unequally yoked. All right, and I think this applies here. Marry within the tribe, and that's the solution to a whole lot of problems that could come up. So, the inheritance of the children of Israel shall not change hands from tribe to tribe. That's not the way it's going to work. It'll stay intact. Marry within the tribe. That was God's instruction. "For every one of the children of Israel shall keep the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who possesses an inheritance in any tribe of the children of Israel." So in other words, this was a statute that was changed. And this could happen again in the future. So any time that a daughter in any tribe of Israel inherited her father's property, then it was to be that she should be the wife of one of the family of her father's tribe, so that the children of Israel each may possess the inheritance of his fathers. Thus no inheritance shall change hands from one tribe to another, but every tribe of the children of Israel shall keep its own inheritance. And just as the Lord commanded Moses, so did the daughters of Zelophehad. And then it names all five of them again, and we're going to talk about that in just a little while. And it says that they were married to the sons of their father's brothers. So did they do what God commanded Moses and Moses commanded them? Or what God instructed Moses? Yes, they did. They were honorable. And that's why God was able to deal with them as he did. And it says that they were married into the families of the children of Manasseh, which kept the inheritance with the tribe of who were the descendants of Joseph. And the inheritance remained in the tribe of their father's family. These are the commandments and the judgments which the Lord commanded the children of Israel by the hand of Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan across from Jericho. Okay? And that's the end of chapter 36, unless we have time to come back to it. And I don't know that we will tonight, but we're going to, because there's more here. For you to keep it. That's good. That's a good point. You're the very reason we're going to come back and talk about this tonight.
About the city of refuge, an
yes,
observation just won't go out.
Okay, go ahead.
They couldn't leave the city and live until the high priest died. Jesus is our high priest, and he died, and that gives us freedom. We can go anywhere we want.
Good, because who is our refuge? He is. That's a good point, Kenny. And he's also our rest, isn't he? He's our sanctuary, our high tower. Okay, good. Now, before we review for the test, I'm going to put up something on the board that I believe will help you. I worked on it this afternoon, and it helps me. Sometimes we need a visual picture of things, and I think if you'll follow with me, for just a minute, and you don't have to copy this, but you can look at it. See if it helps you. Then when we go through these questions, I think you'll understand why the answers are what they are, and you won't be so confused, because we've got some names to remember and some families to remember on our test, okay?
Here we go.
All right. In Numbers 3:17, if you want to look there. Oh, quit your moaning and groaning. Sound like some other people we've been reading about. Murmuring and a murmuring. 3:17, look just a minute with me. It says, and these were the sons of Levi by their names. There are three of them, okay? And that's what this part is about. And who were those sons?
Gershon,
Merari, and Kohath, okay? All right. Now, remember this, and we're not going to go back and read all this, but I'll give you references for it when we go through it. But in Numbers 3, 25 and 26, when it gives the breakdown of responsibilities for the tabernacle, maybe it'll do you good to go back and look at it. Look at 25. You're in Numbers 3, right?
Yep.
Look at 25 and 26, and tell me what the Gershonites were responsible for. All right, so I'm going to put coverings and curtains, okay? And how were the coverings and the curtains to be carried?
With
oxen. Okay, on carts, that's right. Remember, these things were made by man, and so they were carried on a cart. Okay, look in 3:36 and 37, and tell me what the Merarites were responsible for.
It's pillars and sockets and tabernacle and molds.
Okay, and all that wooden heavy stuff, and that's called the structure or the framework of the tabernacle. And how was that to be carried?
Carts.
On carts. That's heavy, isn't it? Okay. Now, let me just say this. When it says the sons of Gershon, the sons of Kohath, the sons of Merari, it means descendants. Okay? So this is not all of their exact boys. This is their boys and their boys and on down. Okay? So we're talking about descendants. And that's what all these little dots are about. Okay, and it talks about Moses, Aaron, and Miriam being the children of, somebody needs to help me with this, I looked it up today and I forgot it. Is it Amram? Moses' daddy? Amram, okay? Now, it says he was the son of Kohath, but a descendant is what that means, okay? So we're not going to worry about how far down the line Amram was. But somewhere down here was, am I spelling this right? A-M-R-A-M? Okay? And he had well, these really should be under this one. Okay. He had Aaron. And he had Miriam. And then there was a little baby born during the time that all the male children were to be put to death. And his sister, whose name was Miriam, helped his mother, who put him in a basket and floated him down the river. And Miriam stayed to watch, remember? And she saw her baby brother Moses being taken in by the Pharaoh's daughter. And it was Miriam who went to the Pharaoh's daughter and said, would you like me to find you a Hebrew nurse for this Hebrew child? And made the connection for her mother to nurse and nurture Moses in the house of the daughter of Pharaoh. So when we talk about Miriam, that's the same little girl that we're talking about, okay? Now, these are descendants of the tribe of Kohath, and that's all of these are Levites, okay? But not all of them were priests. Because God said Aaron would be the what? What was his position? He's the high priest. Moses would be the leader, the president, right, the leader of the nation. And only Aaron's son could be the what? The priest. That's right. All right, so let's look at his sons just a minute. You remember Nadab and Abihu? Those were two of them. All right, why don't we read any more about those two? Good for you. You guys are good. Okay, they offered strange fire, and for doing that, what happened? God killed them. Yes, they did. Okay. Then we have another. All right. Do you remember anybody under any more of these? What? And one called Ithamar. Okay, those four sons of Aaron by name. Now, no offense, but I'm going to go ahead and get rid of these two. Don't make fun of my chart, Howard. All right. Do you remember anybody under any more of these sons? I heard somebody say it. Benny has. Spell that for me. Is that it? That doesn't look right, but it's close. It might be right. What did he do?
He threw a spear, stopped the play, killed a spear chip.
He threw a spear and killed a,
the Midianite girl
and the man who brought her in.
That's right.
And saved the plague, didn't he? And God said he did it for the zeal of me. That's right. Okay. And then you remember Miriam and then Moses. But these were the sons, and this was the part of the family right here. Whoops. Aaron and his sons, and that means descendants too, because remember he told Phinehas that because of what he did that he would be high priest in the place of his father when the time came, right? Eleazar. So this was the priestly line. Okay? These were the priests.
So Caiaphas and Jesus' day, was that a little bit?
Oh yeah.
The day was in it.
That's right. Then he should have been able to trace his lineage right back to here. Now, do you see why it isn't correct to say the Levites were the priests of the Old Testament? Part of them were, but the vast majority of them weren't. Only the sons of Aaron could be the priests. You got it? Because that's one of your questions, and I don't want the confusion. And then the other thing, let me just do this too. This man, Ithamar, is given oversight. One of Aaron's sons is given oversight over the work, the job description, and the carrying out of the job description of the Merarites and the Gershonites. Okay? Eleazar, before he becomes high priest, is given oversight over the Kohathites and their job, what they wanted. I mean, they didn't understand why they couldn't do.
Okay. Hey, Pat, David, you know, you asked that question.